This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 23rd of October, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. On this week's show, we head across London to the Typo Talks. Three times a year, once in Berlin, once in San Francisco and then in London, the great and good of the graphic design community gather to talk, share and muse on the state of the industry and its future direction. In Logan Hall, London, we spoke to a series of the esteemed talkers who we'll be visiting over the next hour. First up, we speak to legendary, outspoken graphic designer and co-founder of Typo, Eric Spiekerman.
British packaging is out there. The newspapers are the best in the world, I personally think. Some of the magazines are. The music scene is great, and all these people need visual communication.
Meanwhile, over in New York, we sit down with gallerist, collector, and hero of mine, Murray Moss.
What I wanted to do was to create a new model, which was based on an 18th century idea of what if there was no emerging middle class? What if there was no shops, no high street?
And over in Milan, we attend the MADE Expo of Building Materials to take the temperature of the Italian construction industry.
We've seen in the last 10 years growing the market for wood houses and wood construction very strongly here in Italy.
Hard hats at the ready. That's all to come, plus much more too, of course, on this week's episode of Section D. Last weekend saw Typo Talks, the world's leading graphic design conference, descend on London's Logan Hall for two packed days of discussions and lectures about the state of the graphic design industry. Typo's German co-founder, Eric Spiekerman, is known as the grandfather of typography, a title he accepts begrudgingly. His typefaces are considered to be modern classics, and he counts some of the biggest businesses in the world among his clients. But Eric's also a teacher, and his belief in inspiring the next generation of designer is part of his reason for co-founding the Typo Talks. He explained to Monocle's James Pearson the thinking behind Typo London's theme, social.
The problem with those themes is they're both limiting and redundant in a way. Social is like, you know, what isn't? I mean, what isn't social? But some, as you may have heard this morning, people do take the theme. Maybe they don't talk about social, but they certainly take it as a premise to focus their thoughts. So, you know, if their work is maybe not social, whatever that means, they will talk about the social aspects of how they work in their studio, like we heard this morning from somebody. So while they don't have social, you know, quote-unquote clients, social also means working together, cooperating, sharing a space, being nice to your neighbors, as it were. So that word, it means something else for everybody. We do work in so studio environments, you know, 10 of us, 20 of us, in my case, we have 100 people in Berlin, Amsterdam. So that is a social environment. My job as a boss is to create an environment where these people will enjoy working.
Why hold the conference in London?
Well, obviously London is still the European design center by sheer size. I mean, there are more designers here than anywhere else, probably more than in some countries put together in the rest of Europe. And because everybody's here and all these, you know, it attracts people from across the world, the scene is really, really lively. And suddenly London is a village. I mean, if you're in a design business and you hang out in a couple of places in Clerkenwell, a couple of other locations in around Hoxton Square, you are surrounded by your peers, which is also very cool. People move around and knowledge moves around and people do see themselves as part of a design scene, which is very useful, I think.
Do you think in England and the UK compared to, say, on the continent or in America, we appreciate the importance of graphic design as much? Is it more of a kind of add-on or the icing on a cake rather than integral to a product?
I don't think it's any different. We have the same issue that every graphic designer in the world has, or every designer has. They always complain about clients bringing us in too late, wanting us to add the icing on the cake. You have certain industries. I've done a lot of work for the car industry in Germany, which lives by design. I mean, the only reason why people would buy an Audi over a Skoda is design, because they're the same cars, essentially. As we know, I did the branding for both of them. So that makes a large, gives us a large amount of clients, at least in Germany, that depend on design because it makes the difference. In Britain, you have a long and big history of retail, because industry has basically gone away in Britain, which is too bad. But you have the Paul Smith of this world, you know, people who make beautiful things in fashion, in retail. You have your various luxury goods, you have perfume, you have, you know, jams and stuff. So Britain is very much the place that we all learn from. The supermarkets here are the best supermarkets, the food supermarket. You know. There's no Waitrose anywhere else, for example. An upmarket place that still sells ordinary milk and yogurt. So we learn from that, that British packaging is out there. The British press, the newspapers are the best in the world, I personally think. Some of the magazines are, the music scene is great, and all these people need visual communication. They all bring in designers early on because they know, because they're in the communication business. Whereas the manufacturing business still, at least in Britain, doesn't quite see us. They see us as the glorifiers, you know. Dare I say this, but, you know, we get hired to polish the turd. That's basically what we do. Whereas that part of industry in Germany has realized maybe 25, 30 years ago that they need design as an integral part from the start.
The talks this year are being held at the University of London. You've got hundreds, if not thousands, of students attending. What do you want them to take away from these talks?
Well, there's always two things, three things actually. One of them is to mingle, hang out with each other, talk to peers, preferably from abroad, talk to some of the heroes, or at least to some of the older people who lecture or also in the audience. So it's the mixing, you know, the mix and mingle, the meeting people. That's, I think, actually the most important part. The second thing is, of course, to listen to lectures, and there may be 20 lectures and one of them just really hits you, hits the nerve, changes your life, essentially. I've had some of those come to Jesus experience where I thought, oh my God, you know, wow. Not because of this guy is so great or his work, but it hits something. That's something that you've been thinking about and you weren't aware that we've been thinking. So that will happen to most people here, that they take at least one thing home with them that be kind of an epiphany. And the third thing, of course, is actually the spread of knowledge. I mean, there are people out there who are lecturing who know a lot of stuff. And you can find out, oh, this is what it'll be like once I get a job in a studio.
And very quickly, could you just give me a brief list of the mixture of speakers you've got, where they're from?
What we do is we bring people in different ages, like, you know, people who are early in the business, people who are established, and there's always a couple of names, and that's a commercial thing. You bring in somebody like Paula Scher or Josh Davies, people who've been in the business forever, who have a big name. I mean, they also sell tickets. They also have great stories to tell. We always run the risk of, we always bring in a couple of newcomers, people who haven't spoken before or not widely. And more often than not, some people do great work and can't talk about it, and some people can talk about anything even if they don't do great work. There are some entertainers out there that could, you know, present the TV program, and, you know, the printed TV program or the timetable, and they'd be entertaining. That's always the mix, people who entertain, but people who teach, people who lecture, people who convince, people who open your mind. It's also looking at asking locals. We ask people in London, you know, who are the people who are moving things in London right now? So you bring those in. If we go to San Francisco in next year, we'll find a couple of newcomers there. You know, we ask around who does cool stuff. Whether they're famous or not, it doesn't matter.
That was Eric Speakerman there with James Pearson at the Typo Talks in Logan Hall. And we'll be hearing from a handful of the speakers throughout the show too. But in the meantime, we're dashing over the Atlantic to New York. Gallerist and curator Murray Moss has long been one of the leading figures in contemporary American design. He opened his eponymous Moss Gallery in 1994 on Soho's Green Street, which quickly became one of the world's top destinations for groundbreaking design. After many years in the retail sphere, Moss closed the gallery last January to open the Moss Bureau, a design advisory service where he consults collectors, designers, museums, university programs, and anyone who's interested. Over the last 7 months, he's been busy putting together an auction for Phillips de Puri, focusing on dialogues between art and design. Monocle's Barrett Austin recently sat down with Moss for a preview of the auction he's curated and to find out more about the Moss Bureau.
What I wanted to do was close Green Street in Soho. What I didn't want to do was downsize. What I wanted to do was kill retail. In a sense, it's a romantic model that I'm following. When I opened originally in 94, it was not the place to go for design. So it was a destination one sought. Then what happened was we became a sort of anchor for design. So we became exactly what I was looking to avoid, which was a design ghetto. That drew a lot of interested people, which I'm appreciative of, but also a majority of people that weren't there to buy. We became a sort of quasi-educational, quasi-museum experience. And as the numbers increased in terms of the traffic, the rent went up. So we sort of shot ourselves in the foot. What I wanted to do was to create a new model, which was based on an 18th century idea of what if there was no emerging middle class? What if there was no shops, no high street? So I wanted to go to an area which was inaccessible. So we went to the garment district, 10th floor, in a building that's very sort of romantically 1895. And it's a combination office space, bureau, I use the old-fashioned term, which is the background for pockets of display of work that's shown on a much smaller scale, but in my opinion, sort of equally dramatic, because rather than being in front of the curtain, we're now backstage. I've begun curating with museums, with private collections, working on interior, but in very surgical areas, as it were, not interior design, working in commercial spaces. I work with universities. So I'm out there trying to sort of see what will be next. And that brings us to one of the activities that occurred since the beginning of the year, which was this Philips de Paris auction. I had this idea. We needed to raise money. But I thought, as an activity, I would like to augment that with something that would be less literal and something that would compensate us in more than monetary ways, something that I could learn from and come away with, regardless of how successful monetarily or unsuccessful an auction might go. The problem is auction houses are so departmentalized, and they teach you to shop, to look, to think in a very categorical Noah's Ark way. Contemporary photography from 1950 to 1972, contemporary painting, classical painting, still life, you know, it's all so broken down. And I thought, that's not how I think, and I know it's not how we learn. So what it basically thought I would challenge was the comp system of what was the price raised by the last sale of the two-bedroom apartment in the same line. That's how they do it. So I have a black Martin Boss table, and the value that would be given to that table, the criteria that would be used to assign value to it, would be what did the last black Martin Boss table sell for? And I thought I would ask people to sort of put that on hold for a moment and approach a parallel, which was, what is there about this table that, what is it actually about, other than being a black Martin Boss table? And in this case of the black Martin Boss table we happen to have in the sale, it's about the fact that it's actually sculpted. It's Martin works with clay and sculpted it, and did so, in my opinion, quite beautifully. So I thought, why don't we compare it to something that is considered not furniture? It doesn't mean that the Martin Boss table isn't a surface that you can eat a spaghetti dinner on, but I don't see any reason why it should be punished for that. That's a bonus. But it's nonetheless sculpture, so why don't I pick a really good sculpture, not any old sculpture, but why don't I find a Giacometti and put it on that table and be audacious enough to say, they both are sculpture, aren't they? And then the 40 to 60,000 estimate, to be crass, for the Boss table compared to the 2 to 3 million for the Giacometti might cause one to think a bit. And that was my ploy. It survived miraculously to me that there are montage, that it looks like an exhibition. It looks intentional. But an auction, how do you make such a fluid business that changes every day, where people can sign something, then they pull out at the last minute, then something gets added, that it's disparate. You can't control the things that are submitted unless it's a unique one collection show, which this isn't. So how do you make an exhibition? How do you make mise en scène? How do you make montage out of random ingredients in this dynamic.
If you could tell us a little bit about what's in the sale, what would we see here?
What you're going to see is something that looks, first of all, planned. It doesn't look ad hoc. It looks intentional because, and what I wanted to show were, for example, things that look alike.
What do you suppose will end up getting the most attention? Which items will bidders perhaps be fighting for?
Well, I hope the bidders are listening. I mean, in a more perfect world, it would be the more esoteric pieces. But I think from our collection, my collection and Franklin's, is a wall unit, a wall organizer by the Italian architect Gio Ponti. And that for me is the sort of poster child of this auction.
As one final question, if you were to leave with something yourself, what would you take home?
There are many things here which I truly love, but I would take back what we consigned, which was this vase by Helle Jongerius, a Dutch designer and a dear friend of mine for many years, which is a very large hand-built clay Chinese-looking vase, which is called the Giant Prince. And why this moves me is because Helle, through her eyes, in that instance, destroyed all the guild system that's existed since the Middle Ages. What she did was to take embroidery, sewing, and use that method of decoration to apply it to another discipline. And she does so unselfconsciously and beautifully. And so, what, 2,000 years of guild strictness of categorization falls away.
That was Murray Moss there with our researcher Barrett Austin in New York. And we'll be heading back to the Typo Conference after this short break.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Second Cycle is a special kind of upscaling that understands consumers' connection to objects with a personal history. Monocle Films travel to Helsinki to watch Finnish furniture brand Artek hunt down old items and bring them back to life.
It was quite an emotional thing for all of us. When we went through the flea markets and schools and kindergarten from where we bought these things, we took them to our office and our employees started to say that Mirko, don't do anything to them. Don't touch them, don't hurt them. Let them be as they are.
You can watch this Second Cycle film and many more films in the program's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D. As well as featuring some of the biggest names of the graphic design world, this year's Typo Talks made ample space on the platform for up-and-coming stars too. Kate Moros, who founded her own creative design practice, Studio Moros, just last year, was one such talker. At just 26, Moros already names Nike and Nokia among her many clients, but music remains her priority. And she's best known for her album covers and posters containing three-sided shapes, illegible typography, and free-form lettering. She explained her talk, DIY, the Riot Girl model, to James Pearson.
It's kind of about me picking up on Riot Girl and punk and DIY in my early 20s and how I've applied that sort of naturally and organically to my business and my sort of ethos on life and design. I'm talking less about my work and more about my approach, what I think is important, and talking about the social aspects of those sorts of subcultures. Music is intrinsic to society and I think that it has to be wrapped somehow, so I feel like visualising music is my goal in life, and in whatever way I can do that, whether it's through merchandise or CDs or videos or, you know, live events, that's what I love to do in design.
Do you briefly just go over your background, how you got into what you do?
At about 18, 19, I started designing people's MySpace pages for them. As a sort of compromise on the coding, I would start to sort of design banners and do a little bit of illustration for them. And then I learned Dreamweaver and started building websites for bands. They're dreadful websites. I'm sure they had them rebuilt quite soon after I'd worked on them. But it was at the age where web was a professional world. It wasn't a rookie world. And I sort of broke that boundary, I guess, of having a website when I didn't even have time to have a job. I just had my work up there, and that's how I saw it. I wasn't afraid, and I had portfolio up from a really young age and did a few press pieces, and people went to my website, and I did flyers and band posters, and I would just do anything and everything I get my hands on. I worked for free for like a year of just drawing and making things, and from there it just sort of spiraled, and I never say no. I always try new things. Someone's like, oh, can you make me a video? I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll go make a video. It's that DIY, just go out and do it. If you don't know how to do it, learn how to do it.
The clients you work for, the music labels and the artists and the companies, they want something, like many other businesses, that's really cutting edge and new and original. How do you stay at the center of attention?
I think the most important thing is not to try to be cutting edge and original, is just to listen to the artists and the fans and try and bridge the gap and produce something that they will like and that the artists will be happy to stand in front of. And I think as long as you do that honestly and with integrity, I think then hopefully the work will be original.
I mean, is it collaborative, or is it very much you have to have control of what you're designing?
I only choose to work with artists that I can collaborate with. It's very much a process in which I work with them to visualize their music. It's not something I can do blind. And, you know, that is a very, very important part of the process, absolutely.
Give a flavor of the projects you've worked on or are working on at the moment.
So about a year ago, I started working with a girl called Jessie Ware. She hadn't really released any solo material, and we sort of developed a logo and a single, like a 10-inch single. And from there, we sort of went on to promo videos. So directed 4 videos for her, gone on to do all her album artwork, her live show visuals, anything and everything that you see of Jessie's is mine, and her kind of collaboration together. And she's recently, she got top 5 in the album charts and is nominated for a Mercury. So that's the kind of best case study I can give you. A lot of the other artists I work with are much smaller and more niche, but she's a good mainstream example.
What sort of stuff are you doing for Jessie Ware at the moment? What does it look like?
I kind of said recently that, I mean, I'm most known for sort of my hand-drawn typography and sort of geometric graphics illustration, but I don't really want to have that. I don't want that to be my style. I want my style to be invisible. I want it to be a mood or a feeling or a cohesiveness or just the idea that somebody thought about it. I want people to recognise that rather than the aesthetic. And I think especially when you're working with musicians, the aesthetic changes from artist to artist, album to album even. So I think as long as the ideas are strong, I'd like to say that I have strong ideas that are simply executed. I don't think my work is, you know, particularly well crafted or like insanely complicated or high tech. It's all quite simple, but it's just about that simple idea, applying it well and packaging the music in a way that's sensitive to the sound of the actual tracks.
And the theme of Typo London this year is to be social. How do you approach that in your talk? I mean, do you think you're a social designer yourself?
Definitely think I'm social. All my work and success has come from my social activity when I was younger.
There's hundreds of students, maybe even thousands, who are turning up for these talks, including yours. I mean, do you have a message for those budding graphic designers or typographers?
There is no wall. I think that a lot of students now think there's a big division between them and the professional world. And I think it's about just like removing that obstruction, that fear. And I think it's just about going for it. And I didn't have that, so I was lucky that it didn't exist for me, just through how I grew up and the people I was around when I was sort of coming of age, essentially. But that would be my message, is break down the wall and break through it and don't think about it like that, and just go out there and just make work and be awesome.
That was the inspiring young designer Kate Moross with James Pearson there at the Typo Talks in London. And not far from Logan Hall, over in the Barbican, we dropped by a new exhibition called Urban Notations. In an age where cities are constantly being transformed, classic builds knocked down and steel and glass high-rises erected in their place, we're increasingly relying on architectural photography to tell the story of how urban landscapes are changing. Easy as it is, though, to document buildings in photographs, it's a little more tricky to capture how they shape their urban environment and how people use them. James Pearson visited Urban Notations at the Barbican and spoke to German artist Ruth Hommelsheim to find out how she uses her camera to capture not just its photogenic form, but its character too.
The Barbican. It's bold, brutalist, yet to some it's also beautiful. It's a place dominated by architecture, with narrow corridors, cavernous inner spaces, and man-made waterfalls. All of this shapes the lives of those who live there and those who pass through it every day. German photographer Ruth Hommelsheim is just one of those who visited this centre. And like most, she was inspired to create a lasting impression of her visit.
I was immediately very fascinated by the architecture and was really like, I had to walk around and record what I was seeing. And I do it on a normal 35mm camera. I walk around, take a lot of pictures, and then I roll back the film, put it in the camera again so that the two layers are overlapping, and then I walk around again and a second layer of images is recorded or notated on the film.
Once Ruth has taken a second set of shots over the first, she then develops and enlarges the images. The effect is impressive, with one landscape superimposed on the other. It's part of a series of photographic exhibitions she's called Urban Notations.
This Urban Notations is a long-term project that I work on for about 10 years or more now. All what you can see when you walk around the Barbican and in the public space. So it's the architecture, it's the buildings, it's people walking around, it's the nature. There are gardens in the Barbican.
If you were to walk through the Barbican and remember it 10 minutes later, this kind of mixture of shapes and images, that would be how you'd remember it. And that's how it's sort of represented in these images.
Yes, it's how you said. You don't remember one image, you remember a lot of images which overlap in your brain or in your memory.
Do you think that this exhibition captures all of the Barbican, or its little nooks and crannies? Do you think this captures the feel of the centre?
It captures what I felt about the centre, of course, but I think as it's quite a long way through the centre, it captures quite a lot of different perspectives and views. But if somebody else does it, or if I did it today, it would be different, of course.
I brought Ruth back to the centre to retrace her steps and describe how she captured the essence of the complex. With us is Marianne Müller, an architect at Kaspar Müller Nier, a practice based in the estate, and who are also hosting Ruth's exhibition.
This would be an interesting perspective, maybe.
If I would see that, if I had a camera with me now, I would take a picture of this, the different shapes and the different kind of light.
So we've got the public space with the large plant pots, the trees, and then we've got the six-floor curved building behind, and then the skyscraper behind that.
Yeah, and the lines of the stairs and the door here and a different light. It's important to have shadow and light in every picture. That helps to merge the two layers.
We're sort of in the bowels of the Barbican here, in one of the kind of inside kind of corridors. It's all, what would you call this?
Concrete.
It's all concrete. It's all kind of hardened concrete, which is quite rough to touch. And a lot of straight kind of ramps and staircases. And this is another side which you take an image of.
Yes, I remember the lights which appear in several parts of the film. And that could have been one of the perspectives.
And it's quite striking how we've gone from quite a claustrophobic space, which is very low ceilings, all concrete all around you. We're coming out now across the bridge into the big public space, the lakes and the fountains. I mean, this is important to, as well as showing both these different types of space, capturing the bit in between as well.
Yes, and the surprising views you have when you walk around. Because as I was here the first time, I didn't know what expects me. And just like we did it right now, we came around the corner and then we have this view on the water and the plants and the other things coming out of the very narrow space.
Okay, we're back inside the office now. We're looking at the film as it's laid out, as it's been enlarged along the sides of the room. And you've really taken all types of images and laying them across each other. And as a result, we can get a mixture, because of the two films that you've laid down, a mixture of different spaces, different shapes. Marianne, as an architect working in the Barbican, designing buildings in London, what do you see in these images? Have they a real use for you when you're trying to, say, build something in that environment?
I think they're interesting for us because they present a certain perspective on viewing the city. Because as architects, we often have a particular perspective that is closer to the one of God. You look down onto the building, you look at the city from above with a map-like perspective, whereas Root somehow turns that around and puts the perspective down to ground level. And I think it's very interesting that Root picks up on that and that she's actually exploring all these cities through walking tours. It's just, again, related to memory or experience.
Do you think that's a problem for maybe some architects today, that they don't have this perspective of the area or the building they're designing from a view of a member of the public? It's just sort of the architect's eye, what they're drawn to, rather than what somebody who's just walking through thinks of.
As I have to say, I'm usually terribly disappointed by architectural photography, because it captures the spaces that you experience and remember as being alive and in motion. They capture them often in a static way, which become, although very useful, documents of these spaces or buildings. But yet, I always feel they actually lack something, because they're actually not akin to memory. They're not actually how we remember them, but they're completely different.
Leaving the brutalist courtyard of the Barbican behind, we hopped on the bus back to Logan Hall for an inspiring talk by Lucien Roberts. Roberts is passionate about making graphic design engaging and accessible to the mainstream. Her latest business, Graphic Design And, is a publishing company dedicated to making books about graphic design, showing and explaining the value it adds to all walks of daily life. We grabbed her for a few minutes after her talk to find out her plans for the business.
We're not making books about graphic design for graphic designers, although it's lovely if they want to buy them, of course, but we really want to make sure that our books are accessible to a non-graphic design audience. I've written lots of graphic design books and designed a lot of graphic design books, and I know it's quite a closed world, the graphic design publishing world, that on the whole, those are books that are produced for people who already understand what graphic design is. Whereas what I was interested in with Rebecca, my co-founder, was that graphic design is actually, it's everywhere, seen by everyone, used by everyone, but most people don't even know that that's the thing that they're using or seeing, and they don't understand the effect that it's having upon them. So our first book is called Graphic Design and Literature. Well, it's a graphic design and literature title, and it's called Page One, Great Expectations. And we were interested in asking designers to lay out the same text over and over and over again. So we asked 70 designers to lay out the first page of Great Expectations. We were interested in exploring what it is that graphic designers bring to laying out text. Now, 70 is a lot. So we've got the same text over and over and over again, laid out differently every time. We chose Great Expectations partly because obviously everyone's familiar with it, partly because it was the bicentenary of Dickens' birth this year, and partly because that particular text talks about lettering. Pip, the protagonist, is looking at the gravestones of his parents, trying to work out what sort of people they were. He's an orphan. And he looks at the lettering as a clue as to what kind of people they were. So there was a lovely story, you know, the story itself played into our hands, if you like. I think it clearly demonstrates what graphic design brings to any subject, actually. But certainly the reading of that novel, depending upon the font it's set in, whether it's one column, two column, where you place emphasis, so what's bigger or smaller, all these things have a bearing on how you interpret that text, and that's what we were interested in exploring.
I mean, that was a project that seems quite celebrative of the graphic design that's out there. In terms of business, are you finding that books is where the industry's heading these days, rather than for prints or posters for campaigns or organisations?
We had a little bit of trepidation about the book and whether it was an object that was on the way out, if you like. What we found is that we have almost sold out. We're contemplating whether to do a reprint. You know, it's gone phenomenally well. So that was interesting in itself. But I think there's something about the tactile quality of the book, the intimacy of it. All of these things seem to still work very, very well, actually. And of course, and designers do love books, I have to say. So they love producing things for books. Partly because they're in... I think the assumption is that people keep books. So they're one of the few things that graphic designers produce that has longevity. Most of what we produce is ephemeral. Most of it ends up in the bin. And we have to come to terms with that psychologically, and that can be quite hard.
And if there's a theme to the Taipo Talks this year, it's to be social. How important is being sociable, collaboration in graphic design?
Well, we've interpreted that theme in two ways, really, in the talk. One was, as you say, about collaboration, but also that, you know, I don't see graphic design as a sort of solo occupation. You collaborate with other designers quite often, or image makers in my case, because I'm more of a typographer, writers, clients, up to a certain extent. You're always thinking about the people who are going to use whatever it is that you're producing, and then you can't generally make it on your own. You know, you need printers, or you need some web coder, or you need, you know. So it's very collaborative as a process. And then, of course, it's out there in the world, so it's utterly socially engaged once it's distributed. And it's all about mass production, really, graphic design. That's what also makes it exciting.
And in your talk, you were talking about for a successful designer who's created a design, often they have to deal with it when they stop having control and other people pick up that brand, that logo, and take it with them and change it and alter it. What's your experience of that?
Yeah, in the talk, I talked about a logo that we did for a trades union, the UCU. And, you know, working for a trades union ticks all the boxes for me politically. And it's fantastic seeing our logo on a massive banner at a demonstration or something, if it's something that you support. But at the same time, because of the nature of that kind of organisation, there are lots and lots of people who are members who are going to want to sew this logo onto a banner, or draw it by hand, or colour it in with funny felt tips or something, you know. So having carefully letter spaced it, redrawn these letters, lots of attention to detail, you see it gradually kind of fall apart in terms of, you know. And somehow I've had to come to terms with that. But of course I do, because actually I think we're still, hopefully, contributing to getting that message out there in some shape or form.
And this year's talks are in a university. A lot of the people who come to listen to you talk are students. I mean, if very briefly, what message do you want them to take away from your talk and from the whole Taipo?
Well, certainly from our talk, I hope it's an optimistic one. I mean, in that we're saying that we think that graphic design has a heart, you know, and that's what makes it a fantastic occupation and a wonderful thing to engage with. And I'm sure, you know, more broadly, at the core of a conference like this, there has to be that message that it's worth doing it.
That was Lucienne Roberts talking to Monocle's James Pearson there at the Taipo Talks. And we're off to Milan to talk bricks and mortar after this.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly programme on the best in design, architecture, graphics and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back. Now, here on Section D, we regularly hear from architects about their designs for everything from single-family homes to skyscrapers. But behind the scenes, there are countless companies involved in the nuts and bolts of building these projects. Each year, at the MADE trade fair in Milan, hundreds of firms from Italy and abroad gather to show off the latest tools and construction materials used to create our built environment. We dispatched Monocle's Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho, with his hard hat to see what the industry has been up to.
Each year at MADE, thousands of contractors, engineers, architects, and interior designers gather to shop for the latest in sliding doors, jackhammers, and precast concrete. Italy's construction industry is worth 370 billion euros annually, and despite a domestic slump, has stayed upright thanks to exports to emerging markets. While the vast majority of the 1,500 exhibitors flew the Italian flag, foreign companies weren't hard to find, with many promoting exotic materials to be used in future homes. Mario Cassin, president of Monaco-based Belief.
What you're hearing is actually banana fiber sheet, which has been produced only with 100% with banana and glued together and bonded together with its own resin.
This comes from the trunk of the tree then?
Yes, of course. We found out about 5 years ago, after four generations of working into the panel and wood industry, that within the banana plantation, every time you harvest a bunch of banana, there is a tree which has to be cut and fell down in order to allow the other tree which is behind it to produce another bunch of banana 6 months later. We found a way of using this byproduct and produce these sheets which we were talking before, and then this sheet can be used in different utilization, in the furniture production, in the panel production, or in the parquet flooring production.
When it came to pushing the design envelope, Spain's Inalco, a maker of ceramic wall and floor tiles, stood out from the pack. Nacho Lopez, Inalco's export manager.
Just to give you an idea here, Inalco, the big innovation is to produce a piece of 1 meter by 3 meter with relief. It's the first one in the world showing this material, this process. And the main thing as well is we can decorate it with a digital printer, and after we can cook it at 1,200 degrees. So it brings a very special piece, very strong. You can use in the floor wherever you want with any problem, and with just 5 millimeter thickness.
Now, when I touch the ridges here on this surface, it feels almost like wood.
Exactly. When you close your eyes, you can see you can feel this relief like the real wood. This is what we bring, the naturality to this material that normally ceramic is cold. And here we can show you that it's not that much. Here in this piece, for example, we are speaking about a wooden flooring, but at the same time, you can think in a stone that is very complicated to get it, to have it, the porosity and so on, and we can make it in ceramic tile. Why? Because we have a special production, we have a digital printing, and with this new system, you can make whatever you like. In any relief, you can make it.
Meanwhile, in Hall 2 at the fairgrounds, the focus was on wood. Italy's Rubner Group, known for making single-family homes and hotels out of the material, was promoting the benefits of building in timber. Marco Bernardini, Rubner's marketing manager.
We've seen in the last 10 years growing the market for wood houses and wood construction very strongly here in Italy. Wood is a natural, recyclable material, energy efficient. It's a material that to produce needs only a small percentage of energy, of ray energy, compared to steel or concrete. You also have a lot of advantages in living in a wood home. You know, it's warm, it's comfortable, and you have also, through the wood, you have a humidity regulation that feels very comfortable. Mainly here in Italy, we have some region with a very high seismic earthquake risk. We have seen in L'Aquila, where Rubner has also built a lot, that wood constructions are the ideal construction technology in seismic regions.
And there's time now for one last check-in at the Typo Talks in London. Britt Iverson and Anna Gerber together make up London-based book designers Visual Editions. They started their business together 3 years ago, and every book they produce is done with the principle that the material and design should be every bit as carefully concocted, fascinating and engaging as the stories inside. Iverson and Gerber took time out from the conference to speak to James Pearson.
The angle that we took in terms of what we do is really one of collaboration. So we collaborate on every single book between the author and the designer. And also we collaborate an awful lot with our readers, both when we bring out books and the process of producing them, the journey of producing a book, and then once we have brought the books out in terms of how they feel about the books and the feedback they give us, collections of reading experiences. And then we also collaborate around certain events by getting people to take part and become part of the reading out loud experience, for instance, that we did at the V&A. So it was broadly around collaboration as our social angle.
The title for our talk was We Don't Own Our Books, Our Readers Do. And the idea behind that was to take our audience through the process of making the book. And so that kind of social element comes in with, like Britt just said, that collaboration between us, the designer, the author, oftentimes the printer as well. And then it goes through to actually handing the book over to the outside world and just saying, okay, this is yours now. And seeing how our books are loved and read and used and battered.
And sometimes questioned.
And saying, okay, this is your experience now. And letting go.
And could you just give me a flavour, just a couple of examples of some of the books that you've worked on then?
Our most recent book is called Kapow by Adam Thirlwell, and it was designed by Studio Frith. And it's a book that uses digressions to tell stories around the Middle East and the uprisings. And those digressions take all sorts of different shapes and sizes. So they work as foldouts. The reader has to actually spin the book around at certain points. It's a really engaging, interactive experience. It slips and slides, and it's quite a topsy-turvy reading experience.
Another book is our second book called Tree of Codes by Jonathan Safran-Foer, designed by Sarah DuBont Studio. And that was a book full of holes where the author Jonathan took his favourite book and basically cut a new narrative out of it. He used his favourite book, Bruno Schulz's Street of Crocodiles, as a canvas for his own new story. So when you open the book, you have a different die cut on every single page. So that book is more almost of a sculpture experience as well as a reading experience. Die cut, Anna will explain that better in design terms, but what it is essentially is you're creating massive plates that cuts holes in papers. So you end up with this particular book is every single page on the book. Inside the book, once you open the cover, it is full of holes, basically bits of paper missing from each page. So what you're reading is the text that's left on the page that hasn't been cut away. So every time you lift a page up to change the page, to turn the page and read it, the next page in the book, you're turning up a page full of holes.
No design, technical.
Design way of explaining it than that.
I don't think there is. I guess what's unusual about it is for every page of die cuts, you have to build a whole new frame, which is really expensive to do. So we approached a number of printers around the world to make the book. And printers wouldn't even quote on it. They just said this is actually physically impossible to make. And we found one printer in Belgium called Decure, who were the first people not to say that it was possible, but to say that they would try. And they persevered, and they tried. And the way that they managed to do it is they ended up outsourcing almost every single component of the book to specialists. So there's an actual die cutter in the Netherlands who build the frames, who did the cutting, and then that gets brought to a special binder who can deal with those die cut pages. So it's a really specialized process.
You're a publishing company, so obviously you concentrate on books. But was it a conscious decision? Is that the way graphic design's going? Is that the way to get people to appreciate graphic design who aren't graphic designers themselves?
No, it wasn't a conscious decision. I have a background in design, so that fed into it a little bit, but it wasn't conscious. I think what's more important to us is reaching out to different types of audiences and seeing what happens. So one of those audiences is obviously a design audience. Another one is a literary audience. And what we get excited about is those audiences sharing a similar experience.
Actually, there's one very big point we talk about quite often, which is never to celebrate, in our work, design for design's sake. We love design work, we love beautiful stuff, but we love it when it fits and when it makes other stuff better. So the visual elements...
When there's a reason for it.
Yeah, the design, if you like, when design in all our work is very much there for a reason. It's never just decorative. It's never just aesthetically pleasing. It's always there as part of the storytelling. So it would never function just on its own.
Do you think that you're going against the grain in terms of publishing, or are lots more designers getting into the publishing world and doing things like this?
I think at the moment there is no grain to go against in publishing, because it's going all over the place, in a good way, for us, we think. It's been forced upon the publishing world to look at things differently simply because of what's happening through technology. So by the fact that a lot of books live beautifully and happily on Kindle, and a lot of book experience can be created as book apps and iBooks, whatever else, it opens up the question, what do you do with the printed matter? So is there still a role for the printed book? Is how lots of publishing people talk about it. And actually what we think is that there's a huge opportunity for printed books, because you need to think about why you're printing them. If there's not a good enough reason to why you would print this thing, you might as well put it on Kindle. But if there is a reason, then do it beautifully. So design-wise, that's a great opportunity. But that opportunity for designers is as much on the screen as it is on paper. It just feels like there's a wealth of opportunity, full stop, to think about how things appear visually.
That was Britt Iverson and Anna Gerber of Visual Editions talking to James Pearson at the Typo Talks in London recently. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be fair hopping from Dutch Design Week in Eindhoven via Kortrijk in Belgium to Orgotech in Cologne. So fasten your seatbelts for that whistle-stop tour. We'll also drop in on Toronto and have a little preview of Tokyo Designers Week too. So heaps to look forward to. This week's show was edited by Holly Fisher, and special thanks go to the indomitable James Pearson too. I'm Hugo MacDonald, and playing you out in honour of the Made Expo in Milan, here's Pink Floyd with another Brick in the Wall. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.